Welcome back, WNST, Towson, Baltimore, and Baltimore Positive. This is going to be a fun one here. We call them intelligent conversations. We call them wise conversations, brought to you by our friends at Wise Market. And I did have the $6 signature crab cake at Wise Market over the weekend. And we're going to be with our mayor, Brandon Scott, as part of the Maryland Crab Cake Tour on October the 8th at Coco's. We've been 6 months in the working with this thing, with masks on, masks off in summertime, all presented by the Maryland Lottery. Let yourself play. Along with former Baltimore County Executive Don Mahler, we present these Baltimore Positive Conversations. Don has had this one in the works for a long, long time. Don, I'm going to let you do the honors because you are contemporaries. There's been a long friendship here. But for those unfamiliar with the General's work, I'm going to be happy to try to read from the Wikipedia, the lengthy Wikipedia. Wikipedia, but I'm allow you to do the honors here.
Well, before you go through the long bio of General Don Schenck, I was saying, General, that of all the guests, I was trying to think of all the guests that have been on the show, I probably have known you and been friends with you longer than anyone. It defies my thought process to think that we've known each other for 53 years. That just does, that can't be, because that means we're pretty damn old. But it's amazing.
1968.
It's
where did you guys meet? Give me your meeting. College?
Yeah. I'll let General talk about it.
Yeah, so we both attended Western Maryland College. I was a year ahead of Don. I was class of 71. He was class of 72. And I'm actually heading off next weekend for 3 weeks in Maryland and Virginia to attend our 50th anniversary that I hope Don's lovely wife, Linda, will be attending as well. I don't want Don to be there. I just want Linda to be there.
I understand. So, well, yeah, we've known each other a long time, probably met Nestor, did meet with some other friends first week. I was on campus and, you know, General Schenck and some others were having a little get together where we had a Diet Coke or two. We've known each other ever since. But why don't you give Nestor, our listeners, a sense of what's really a pretty incredible bio?
Well, I mean, from that period of time to 2004, retiring as a brigadier general and serving our country at every turn. General, just so you know, I met Don in 1982. He was my high school guidance counselor. So I met him, 10 years after he, had done. And I would think you were well on your way to serving our country at that point and spent a life in service, including in Iraq. So I think we bring you on for the expertise. Don brings you on out of friendship, but Don was a social studies teacher, and I missed that part of his life. I kind of came in when he was going the other path. So we've turned this show into social studies. So this is our half an hour social studies course with a Brigadier General. So we welcome you aboard.
Well, thank you. Appreciate it.
Tremendous career, Don. And let's, what I said to Nestor, and I want you to fill in some gaps for me before we get into your career and then post-military career, which is also distinguished, your volunteer career, which is an amazing accomplishment. But I have some gaps in my memory regarding a few things back in 1968 and 69 at Western Maryland College. Here's what I remember. I remember, and for folks who see it in the movies, we were in the midst of the anti-war Vietnam movement at that time. A number of us, a number of our friends, mutual friends, we were heading to D.C. I was in the streets in D.C. We actually had a march on the Armory, National Guard Armory. At Westminster. So there was, for a small little college in Westminster, fair amount of anti-war movement activity reflecting what was happening in the country. And in the midst of this, a young guy from Baltimore City College joins ROTC, begins what will become a distinguished career in the military. And in the midst of all of us who were running around protesting the war, you choose another path. And Don, what I can't recall is how difficult was that for you? There are a couple of questions in here. Was there tension in that? Because I don't recall it. Perhaps you will. And what spurred you to make that decision? There's a lot there.
Okay, so let me try to unpack that just a little bit. So in 1967, when I matriculated into Western Maryland College, out of city, ROTC, and this was the same situation for you the next year, ROTC was a mandatory subject for all male students for their first 2 years of college. Western Maryland College at the time was a land-grant college. It still is, I think, a land-grant college. But at the time, all land-grant colleges across the United States were required to have an active ROTC program or an active military science program. The program at Western Maryland College, which eventually, as we know, became McDaniel College in 2004, I think it was, has a long history. That program has been in existence for over a century. It has produced commissioned officers since the end of World War I. And they recently celebrated their centennial as an active organization. So, as a freshman and sophomore, I had no choice in the matter unless I decided to convert my draft status to conscientious objector, which I was not intending to do. I don't have a long history of military service in my family. My father was an enlisted man during World War II in Korea. He enlisted as opposed to being drafted because he saw what was going to happen. So he enlisted right after he graduated from Boston University. the tension to which you refer was absolutely present, but I will tell you that I did not experience any pushback on me personally, and I think that's a reflection of the difference in the times. Now, today, that would not be the case, unfortunately, but I think people learn to respect and appreciate the views of others. I think people across the campus knew that there was, you know, one path that said the war in Vietnam is an issue. There was another path that says the war in Vietnam is not an issue. The path that I chose said service to the nation is most important to me.
Well, General, I want to interrupt you for a second because this is what Nestor really, I think, appreciates about Baltimore Positive is a history lesson. And you just alluded to something. That's why we love having smart people like you on that I hadn't thought about. The difference of the time and it, how we treated one another, even though it was, people think of the 60s as crazy. And the image I want to give you, Nestor, is while General Schenck and others were fulfilling admirably their ROTC service and going through weekly drills, as I remember it, Don, down on the football field where our fraternity dorm overlooked it, and people from multiple fraternities blaring Country Joe and the Fish, yep, anti-war songs out the dorm trying to drown out the ROTC drills.
What year was this, Don?
68 and 69, right?
Yeah, I was General? Born October 68. Okay. All right. So I'm
am
just
I
gonna
right in
those-
that 68, yeah. 69?
68, 69, early 70. Remember, Kent State right. happened in May of 1970.
And I know exactly. We were all, I can tell you where we were. As you know, we were down, at least a number of us were down in the fraternity clubhouse playing pool, listening to music when that happened. But your point about, and I'm glad to hear you say that, I can't imagine today you coming back to the dorm in your uniform after the rest of us are blaring Country Joe and the Fish out the window and they're not being acrimony. And I just don't recall that. I guess it was just, we thought, hey, that's what Don likes to do. The rest of us are here. We have a good friendship aside from
that. I would think, I'd be thankful somebody be willing to serve in that position as I am with you, Jim. You know what I mean? That would be my generation to say, thank you for your service. It wasn't for me. You know, I went into the journal. I had a different track in life. Don went into education. I went into journalism. You know, someone had to do it, and we appreciate those who do it. So I don't know if we're there. But I always hear about your era that if you came back from Vietnam, there was a lot of pushback from society at that point from being a soldier.
Oh, absolutely. There was there was not a pleasant place to be in uniform back in the late 60s and very early 70s. It was not favorably looked upon for a variety of reasons that are all well documented. But as I indicated previously, what my motivation was all about service to the nation, because I happen to believe that that's an extraordinarily important thing to do. And I made my election to continue in the military science program after I was effectively challenged by one of the instructors of my sophomore year. He came up to me one day in class and asked me point blank why I don't apply for an Army scholarship. And I didn't have a good answer. I mean, I was 19, so I didn't have a good answer. So I applied for an Army scholarship. And I was lucky enough to successfully compete for an Army scholarship. But with that Army scholarship came an active duty service obligation of 4 years. So I knew I was going to go on active duty as soon as I was commissioned in June of 1971.
And the war was still very, you know, much in it happening. You believed you might be going to Vietnam?
You know, there was always that that possibility there. And it caused a little bit of tension between myself and the girl that I was dating at the time. But, we worked through all that. That was a very, very real possibility. And I went to my basic officer training at Fort Knox, Kentucky in the latter part of 1971. And during the course of that, the national decisions were made or in the process of being formulated and articulated to end our ground commitment in Vietnam deliberately. And in 1973, we did that. So in 1971, I'm at Fort Knox. 1972, I go to Fort Hood, Texas, where I served for a little bit over three years. And during that time period, the United States transitioned its roles from active ground combat and support of the Vietnamese government in the early 1970s to withdraw from the country in 1975.
So, General, you have this career. You've got a number of responsibilities as a young officer in the Army, and then in 1991, and this really segues to where we want to tap in to your expertise, both with current military, past military veterans, you end up in combat in Iraq. Talk about that experience, whether or not it was life-changing, and tell us what the American people don't understand about these Middle Eastern conflicts.
Okay, so in 1990, when Saddam Hussein invaded the sovereign country of Kuwait and declared it the 19th province of Kuwait, President Bush and others said, this is not going to stand. They formed a coalition and over time deployed forces, some immediately and some with a very, very deliberate force buildup in the second half of 1990. In November of 1990, we were notified that we were going to deploy to Saudi Arabia from Fort Riley, Kansas, where I was the second in command of a brigade with about 6,000 soldiers. Now, at Fort Riley in 1990 and that time period, all of our existing war plans said we were going to redeploy forces to the Federal Republic of Germany and fall in on equipment that was pre-positioned in Germany. In fact, what happened was we took all of our equipment from Fort Riley, Kansas, and went to Southwest Asia. So as you might imagine, it was a pretty busy time over the November and early December timeframe. I don't think I had a day off, so to speak, from the 7th of November until probably the first single day I can remember not being at work, either in a motor pool or a paint booth or on a railhead. It was New Year's Day in 1991. So we had to deploy all of our equipment from Kansas to Southwest Asia. The air war started in the third week of January, and all of our equipment was on the wrong side of the Strait of Hormuz. So we were a very heavy brigade, two tank battalions, that's roughly 120 tanks, an infantry battalion with another 70 or so Bradley fighting vehicles, two artillery battalions, engineer battalions, et cetera. All of our stuff was on the wrong side of the strait. And we're walking around the port of Adamam, literally walking around the port trying to figure out where we get transportation to move our stuff once it arrives into the desert. So we eventually got that done.
I mean, you're literally there trying to say, how do we get from here to there? I mean, I'm trying to...
Well, I mean, there was a plan. I don't want to leave your listeners to think that we were totally screwed up with no plan. There was a very, very deliberate plan, but the plan is one thing. The execution is another thing. And trying to get people on the ground to move based on what I wanted done, which was to get priority for our movement, was not always an easy thing to do. So for me, it wasn't exactly a transformational thing because we were very, very well trained. We all knew what we had to do. We had actually practiced this kind of a deployment multiple times before, albeit the end position was different. Recall, I said we were planning to go to Germany as opposed to going to Southwest Asia. In fact, the day that it was reported that Saddam Hussein had invaded Kuwait, we were sitting, the leadership of the brigade was sitting in Germany, having just completed our periodic inspection of our equipment that was pre-positioned in Germany in anticipation of having to fight the war against the, this is 1990, so it's a Russian war then in 1990. And we're looking at the newspaper, getting ready to get on our plane to fly back to Kansas. And they're, what the heck is this all about? And then a couple of months later, the Secretary of Defense says, and the 1st Infantry Division from Fort Riley is going to deploy. And we were extraordinarily well trained, and we knew what our tasks were, and everybody knew what their job was. And now it's
6,000 soldiers, that was the number?
That was my brigade, yeah. Okay. So the division deployed roughly 18,000 people out of Kansas and other places because we had to bring in another brigade from Europe to round us out. But it was a pretty dynamic time. It was a lot of sleepless nights, a lot of concern about what was going on. But we eventually, everybody was motivated to get out of the port and into the desert so that we could begin training for the attack into Iraq, which was going to take place in late February. And we did all that. And our operation in Iraq was very, very rapid operation. Our brigade was what's called the main effort brigade for the 7th United States Corps. And what that means is we had all the Corps reinforcing assets and direct and general support assets at our disposal as we breached the Iraqi military defenses that had been arrayed across the desert and attacked into Kuwait and then ultimately into Iraq. Our brigade secured the peace negotiation site in Safwan, Iraq, which General Schwarzkopf used in early March to dictate terms to the Iraqi military. So we went from direct combat operations against the Iraqi military, direct combat operations against the best that they had, the Republican Guard, into a rapid transition into civil military operations as we started dealing now with displaced persons, refugees, evacuees, and things of this nature, sitting astride the Iraq-Kuwait border in the northern portion of Kuwait.
Is this all part of what in our vernacular has become known as shock and awe? Was that part of the shock and awe effort, or was that another?
Let's not mix up our wars.
Okay? I'm going to say that was Afghanistan, right?
Shock and awe was a term used by Secretary Rumsfeld to describe what he intended to do in Iraq in 2003.
Oh, okay. Okay.
So this was... there was no question that we were coming. I mean, there was absolutely no question in anybody's mind that we were coming. I mean, we had a very, very deliberate buildup that started with the deployment of troops out of Fort Bragg, North Carolina, in early August of 1990, through the time that troops continued to flow into Iraq in late January. So even after the air campaign had started, we still have troops flowing in by air and sea. Recall the air campaign started, as I said, the third week of January, and our stuff was on the wrong side of the Strait of Hormuz. So, you know, we're flowing everything into the country. And there was no question that we were coming. So there were probably, I'm sure I don't have my number right, but there were probably on the order of 200,000 troops in Saudi Arabia. And I mean, this is all being reported on CNN. And this is the period of time that you'll recall that CNN came into its own as a global news station. So they're reporting what's going on. And, you know, I got interviewed at one point by some TV or radio station. I can't recall what it was. And they didn't like my interview, so they never published it. They never broadcast it, but that's okay.
We're publishing
it now. How long were you there? How long were you actually in the Middle East, General?
Okay, so during Operation Desert Storm, I was physically present for only about 4 months, which I think is kind of telling because it says we had a direct objective endorsed by the United Nations. We fulfilled the terms of our objective that the United Nations agreed to do, which was to evict Saddam Hussein and restore the territorial integrity of the state of Kuwait. We did that, and then we came out. So the lesson there is, and at the time, recall, Colin Powell was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. The Powell Doctrine said you will have defined military objectives and you will get in and get out and you know what you're going to do when you get out. You're going to know what conflict termination looks like. So we knew what conflict termination was going to look like. So we came out. Forces remained in Saudi Arabia through the 90s up until 2000. Well, they're still there. They remained in Saudi Arabia to support no-fly zones that were put in place. And it was those no-fly zones that effectively sustained the peace that was brokered in 1991. Nestor, you had a question as well.
You know, mine would just be an elementary school question that, you know, the social studies teacher, I feel like I'm a first grader sitting in the general's coming, but I know a little bit more at 53. I'll ask a simple question. What should somebody like me, who's had a very normal life and I've traveled all over the world, I've had a passport, I'm not, you know, I've been to Asia, I've been to Australia, I've been through South America, I've been through Europe. What should we know about war from someone on the inside? What would you tell your 10-year-old grandson or granddaughter about war?
It's very confusing. It never goes the way you think it's going to go.
Well, you said about the exit strategy. You had a different military terminology for when
conflict,
you leave.
Conflict termination.
Conflict. Fair enough. Exit strategy is what we call it in business, right? But every business plan I've ever laid, and I've laid five or six of them in my life, they've never gone the way you think they're going to go. There's never none of right. Don tried to run the county. It never goes exactly how you think it's going to go.
Well, that's not what he said.
It was the only time in history that went exactly according to plan.
But back to keep going on the thoughts on war that what you tell children about war and modern children that have no thought about Kennedy or FDR or the things that my father was born in 1919. So I had chicken in every pot. I had the Depression, like all of that was at my kitchen table every day. I don't know in 2021, other than Vietnam and stories that folks like you tell, where that would be for a young person.
So what I tell my children who are 27 and 30, and what I tell young college men that I counsel and mentor that are interested in a career in the military is I tell them that war is a very, very, it's a very, very dirty business, as you might imagine. There's nothing clean about it. When you look at TV and movies, et cetera, yeah, there's a lot of blood and gore. There's a lot of special effects.
But it goes away in a minute and a half. It goes away when you walk out of the theater.
Number one, it goes away. And number two, warfare is sometimes characterized as long periods of boredom that are punctuated by some very, very violent action. Because
like a MASH episode.
Yeah, well, it's a mashup, but the amount of time that people spend in direct combat, and by that I mean shooting at somebody or having somebody shoot at you, in comparison to the total amount of time that you spend, quote, in war, is very small. It's very small. Most of the time, you're talking about positioning forces to obtain an advantage over an enemy, preparing yourself for whatever the next operation might be. Here's an example. World War II. We deploy forces to Great Britain beginning in 1943. And all they do is train. They train for a year and a half for an operation that's going to consume about 5 days. And that operation is the landing in Normandy. That's what they spend all their time doing. 18 months to prepare for an operation. It's going to take about 5 days. And, you know, for a lot of the time, they're busy. There's no mistake about it. They're busy. They're doing a lot of stuff. But there's nobody shooting at them. The same thing existed when we were in Saudi Arabia in 1991. We did a lot of training in the desert in anticipation of what was going to be a conflict with, you know, direct combat action against the Iraqi military. So we went into the desert, as an example, out of the port. We arrived right about the end of January. And for the next roughly 3 weeks, almost 4 weeks, we trained every single day on exactly what our combat tasks were going to be. And we were very, very visible about it because we didn't want there to be any mistake in anybody's mind that we were coming. And we wanted Saddam and everybody in his government to appreciate the fact that this very, very large force, a coalition force, by the way, it's not U.S., it's a coalition that was put together involving almost every Arab state against Saddam Hussein, was coming against Saddam Hussein. And we were visible. We wanted him to see, wanted him to watch what we were doing, wanted him to get reports from line crossers, spies, if you will, that were watching what we were doing. And then when the final UN resolution was discussed about what was going to happen next, and President Bush said, okay, we're going to do this as a coalition, not as the United States, as a coalition, we went in. Now, war is it's a bloody business. It's a violent business. It's very, very dangerous. People's lives are lost. There's no question about it. We've experienced 5,000 plus deaths in the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan since 2001, since we first went into Afghanistan in October 2001. We've experienced far more life-changing casualties that impact individuals and their family members than the total number of deaths. But every one of those is a loss to the nation in one capacity or another. And what I tell people with whom I interact is you need to understand that if you choose a life that's in the military, you are subordinating yourself to the will of the government. And if you're not prepared to do that, then this is the wrong calling for you. If you are not prepared to do the nation's business, if you're not prepared, so to speak, to write a blank check to the United States of America, then don't do this. Don't do this. But what you will find as a result of your service to the nation is you learn a lot about yourself. You learn a lot about other people. You learn how to make things happen in a very, very tough environment where there's, you know, let there be no mistake about it, these are pressure cooker environments. And you can look back with pride, much the way, President Reagan said when I actually have this quote on my phone. He says, some people live an entire lifetime and wonder if they have ever made a difference in the world. A veteran doesn't have that problem. So you can look back with pride and say, I made a difference. I might have made a difference in the life that somebody leaves in a foreign country. I might have made a difference through my service in the United States, to my hometown, to my community, wherever that might be. I might have made a difference in disaster relief. I might have made a difference fighting forest fires, if that's what the case happens to be, if you're if you're in one of those organizations that ends up doing that. It can be an extraordinarily gratifying career, but it can also be extraordinarily difficult on the individual and his family. There's, and we should never forget, ever, ever forget, that when somebody joins the military, he brings his family with him. She brings her family with her. They come with them, and they experience things that your general listenership and is just not thinking about being involved in.
Well, I want to pick up. That's where I want to pick up on this. Again, we're with retired Brigadier General Donald Schenck. I know you're retired. I know you didn't serve in Afghanistan, but I know how we felt watching what transpired as we tried to terminate our involvement in Afghanistan and culminating, of course, in a tragic attack that led to the death of 13 servicemen and women. The question, and you and I had talked offline a little bit, and I asked you a straightforward question, as you always do. You gave me a straightforward answer, and I'm going to ask you to give it to our listeners. I said, could this have gone differently? Knowing that we were coming out, could we have done it over a period of time? Could we have made it less messy? Did we make major mistakes? Or is this just inevitably what the heck was going to happen? And give us some insight, given your years of experience, General.
You've also been out since 2004, right? So literally 98% of this over two decades, you've witnessed not in the position, but having sat in that chair, correct?
That's correct. I retired in 2004. I retired a couple of years after we'd already won the war the first time in Afghanistan. And then we had the misguided adventure into Iraq that we started in 2003.
That was a tough period. We just went through 9/11, 20-year emotions of this country as you were exiting the military, a completely different country after 9/11, right?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, on September 11th, I was in Washington, D.C. I was very close to the Pentagon. In fact, it was one of the very first times I pulled rank, one of the only times I actually pulled rank on a junior officer was I was in an annex building in Pentagon City, and I was asked to come over to the Pentagon that morning. I said, no, you don't understand. I'm here. You need to see me, Major. You can come to where I am. And it turned out that was a pretty good decision. Wow. I appreciate
serendipity, Nestor. Serendipity.
Back to your questions, though. Could we have done things differently in Afghanistan? Yeah. 2020 hindsight is great. We've got more money morning quarterbacks than we can handle on this particular decision. I think the president's decision was the right decision for the nation. It was a great policy decision. He was the first one to actually follow through on his promise to do this out of four guys. Could it have been handled differently in execution? Absolutely. But nobody knows what all the facts on the ground. I don't care who you are. Nobody actually knows what's involved. And we have to consider the hand the president of the United States was dealt by President Trump. That was a difficult hand to deal with. And he had to deal with that hand. And he chose how he was going to play those cards.
Well, General, I want you to also get into, we had a brief discussion, and boy, it enlightened me. And you said what is so hard for the American people is we really don't understand. I'm going to put words in your mouth, and then you'll make them better. How little loyalty there was on the part of the Afghan people, at least I think this is what I heard you say, towards a central government, that their loyalty was simply to the village and not beyond the borders of the village. Am I capturing what you said to me?
That's effectively it. And it kind of gets to a question that Nestor kind of laid out earlier.
They don't understand.
What is it, right? That we don't understand?
There's no concept of country there, right? Really?
That's correct. And I've traveled extensively across the Middle East and North Africa and South Asia, from Morocco on the east to Pakistan on are going to West, excuse me, Pakistan.
Which will make you a delightful crab cake guest one day.
When
we could talk about things not war related.
Certainly. But we have very little appreciation in this country for what the Middle East is all about. We tend to look at nations around the world through the lens of effectively 1776 and 1787. That's the lens that we looked at. We said, we had a revolution. We have a constitution. It stood the test of time since 1787. We just celebrated Constitution Day last week. And we think everybody ought to look like that. Well, we're the exception. Now, let there be no mistake about it. I happen to believe we are an exceptional nation. But we are also the exception to other nations. When you look in Europe, for example, we tend to think of countries like Germany and France as great nations of long standing. Yeah, they've been in existence as nations since 1870. That's not a very long time.
With tons of turmoil. Scheme,
with a little bit of turmoil, yeah. Germany didn't exist as a nation until 1870. It had a couple of issues after that. It had a couple of changes, fundamental changes in its governmental structure after that. And we have not been in that situation. But we tend to look at things as though everybody should look like us. Now, H.R. McMaster has a term for this. In his book, Battlegrounds, he talks about strategic narcissism. And we think that everybody ought to look like us. Others refer to it as, as hubris. It's American hubris. We tend to think that everybody ought to look like us. And we ought to be able to take our form of government and plop it down on a country like Afghanistan or like Iraq, where there is absolutely no history of governance.
You might as well go to another planet and say, how do they do it on Mars? However they want, right? I mean, for us here, I would say for the war and what happened a couple of weeks ago, the hardest part for me has been watching people who served, who I know, who are a little younger than me, but I know a lot of people that went to war in the last 20 years in various capacities on behalf of our government, and watching it fall apart and then see our weapons in the hands and seeing Pompeo before all of this happened. And having Trump run the military and show up at Army Navy games and, a guy who had bone spurs, who did everything he could do to avoid serving. It was very incongruent for me as a citizen. I can only imagine how incongruent it must have been for people on the inside who served, or someone like you who served for a long time that didn't have to do with this conflict, but clearly have a lot of understanding of this conflict.
Well, there is a certain amount of dissonance associated with it. There's no question about it. But what I try to do is to look at how we ended up in Afghanistan at the end of August through a different lens, without being so focused on the politics, the U.S. national politics of the situation, but instead look at what actually transpired. And what transpired was, over time, we attempted to put in our systems, whether it's governance or economics or banking or whatever, all those things that are the levers of national power. We tried to put those in place into a country that had no experience and no frame of reference for these kinds of things. I mean, Afghanistan, for example, is a cash country. Iraq is a cash country. You don't walk around in downtown Baghdad with your debit card trying to transact business. It's not going to happen that way. So when cash dries up, the economy dries up. These are countries that do a lot of things based on barter. There are huge religious differences in these countries that we don't really appreciate.
They're tribal differences we don't appreciate either, from what I understand, right?
Yeah. So when you ask the question about what about the Middle East do Americans not understand, I'm going to tell you it's most everything.
It's a different way of life in every way.
Everything is different. Everything is different, and you can just kind of I'm going to go on script here for just a second. I'm going to read something that I think is useful for everybody to think about. This is from H.R. McMaster.
Social studies class with the Brigadier General. I love this.
All right. So what he says here is, the problem in the Middle East is, at its base, a breakdown in order associated with the serial failures of colonial rule, post-colonial monarchies, Arab nationalism, socialist dictators, and Islamist extremisms to provide effective governance and forge a common identity across diverse communities. Decades of conflict fragmented societies along ethnic, sectarian, and tribal lines and perpetuated competitions for power, resources, and survival. So, in a nutshell, that's the issue with the Middle East.
Right, yeah. What is it not? Exactly, yeah. We just don't get it at all.
God, it's been such a great visit. We have to have you on more often. Don, I knew you had smart friends.
Oh, I tell you, much smarter than I am. But before we let the general get out of here, Nestor, he's got such a passion for so many volunteer efforts, but we spent so much time today talking about the military. Don, I want you to talk a little bit about your commitment to returning vets, and particularly let folks know about your effort for a charity known as the Fisher House out in Michigan, where you live. Tell us about your commitment to vets and tell us what the Fisher House does.
First off, a vet is a person to whom I take my dog for medical attention. Veterans, on the other hand,
I apologize. Tell us about
people that I'm talking about.
Right. See, he takes me to the woodshed all the time, Nestor.
Well, it's because he was a senior when you were a junior. I learned that in the beginning of the relationship.
It's also because it's so easy to do.
Right. Tell us about your commitment to returning veterans the Fisher House.
You know, I happen to believe that, you know, as President Lincoln said in his second inaugural address, we have a lifelong commitment to our veterans. We have a lifelong commitment to our veterans, those who have served, and to their widows and orphans. And we don't take that necessarily as seriously as we could. It's far too easy to just glibly say thank you for your service without really getting into what you're actually about. I think it's a far better thing to say on Veterans Day or Armed Forces Day or any other time when you see a veteran, say, tell me your story. Don't just thank me. Allow that person to tell his story, much like the two of you have allowed me to tell part of my story today, for which I'm grateful. But ask them to tell you their story, and you'll learn a little bit, not only about the difficult things that they've done, but about a person's character and about what's really, really important to them. And I think that the service that we owe our veterans and their families as a result of their sacrifice is something that I should take seriously because I've got the ability to do that. I've got the ability because I've got the time, I've got the resources, and I've got the grit to go in and go ahead and have those discussions with people. So, Don, I'm going to correct you again here. It's not just Fisher House in Michigan. It's Fisher Houses across the United States and in Europe. So if you will, allow me to speak just a moment. The Fisher House Foundation, which is located in Maryland, in Rockville, I believe, took a challenge from a former Chief of Naval Operations to put in place structures, buildings, if you will, associated with Department of Defense and Department of Veterans Affairs hospitals for the family members of those receiving care in those hospitals to live for free for as long as necessary. And there are about a little bit less than 100 of these put in place around the United States. At Bethesda, for example, at the Walter Reed Army Medical Center, now in Bethesda, there are three, maybe more than that, in place. And these are structures that are put in place. They're gifted by the Fisher House Foundation to the Department of Veterans Affairs or the Department of Defense, depending upon where the supported hospital is located. And these are absolutely first-class facilities for family members to stay while their loved one is receiving care. Because people need to understand, and I'm sure you both understand and recognize this, that when you're suffering with trauma or you've got a medical situation that is front of mind for you and everything that you do, the presence of a family member is all part of that care equation. And a family member's care is just great medicine. There's no question about it. So these houses have been put in place predominantly in the United States, but there's also one in Germany outside of Landstuhl Hospital, and there's also one in Great Britain. where a veteran or his family member or an active duty service member's family can stay rent-free for as long as he's undergoing care. And that's the Fisher House Foundation. There is an offshoot of that called Fisher House Michigan, which I'm involved with here in the state of Michigan, which is has taken its task to support the construction of up to five Fisher Houses in the state of Michigan. Why five? Because there are five VA medical centers in the state of Michigan. One has been constructed and is operational outside the VA hospital in Ann Arbor. Another one is on, has been approved to support the VA hospital in Detroit. And three others, when those VA medical facilities successfully make their petition to have a Fisher House installed there, will be the targets there for that.
Well, General, we'll let you go. But before we do that, folks sitting, driving around, listening to car, listening at home, they say, boy, that sounds like an endeavor I'd like to be a part of. Where can they get online, find more information about the Fisher House, and perhaps make a donation?
Well, bear with me.
I can find it in Fisher House.
The easiest way to do this, and I'll happily send you, I'll send you some information, Don. The easiest way to do it is go to www.fisherhouseoneword.org.
There you go.
Okay, that'll give you basic information on the Fisher House mission, the foundation, et cetera. And then if you're interested in supporting a local Fisher House, then they can direct you to the right spot.
Well, I'm directing them to it right now.
And class is in session.
You can get involved. Upcoming events, volunteer in the Fisher House Golf Classic, helping military families. Big appreciation to the Brigadier General Don Schenck and childhood or almost adolescent friend, college friend of Don Moeller. First but not last, we hope to have you back on the program sometime soon. Thank you very much.
Well, I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
All right. Anybody who wants to come on and give Don a hard time is always welcome here over a crab cake. We're going to have Mayor Brandon Scott with us on October the 8th, joining us at Coco's as part of the Maryland Crab Cake Tour. It's all presented by the Maryland Lottery. Let yourself play. All of our wisdom and intelligent conversations brought to you by our friends at Wise Markets. We do appreciate the Wise conversations as well as the $6 crab cake. And make sure you're rounding up this month as well. Every month they're rounding up to help there. And month by month they're doing great things as well. On behalf of former Baltimore County Executive Don Moeller, I am Nestor Aparicio. You can find me Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, Snapchat, anywhere the Ravens might be. Luke Jones will be out in Owings Mills, all brought to you by our friends at Royal Farms, real fresh, real fast. We are WNSD, AM 1570, Towson, Baltimore, and we never stop talking Baltimore positive.